and a hideous great hair-lipped man comes for the silver. But someday, we are to have it all back again, for I heard my father tell my mother so." Now when Pear Blossom heard this, a small, strange doubt crept into her mind, and she pondered a little, and then she said gently, as though it were a matter of no account, and as though she asked from idle curiosity, "And where does so much silver come from, I wonder? Does your second uncle loan it from his shop?" And the lad answered innocently and proud of his knowledge, "No, they sell the land that was my grandfather's, and I see the farmers come in every day or so, and they take a roll out of their bosoms and unwrap it, and there the silver is, shining like stars when it falls upon the table in my father's room. I have seen it more times than a few, and they do not mind if I am standing by because I am of such little worth." Then Pear Blossom rose so quickly that the little lad looked at her, wondering, for she moved usually very softly, and she checked herself then and said to him in the gentlest way, "I have only just thought of something I must do. Will you look after my poor fool for me while I am gone? There is no one whom I trust as I do you." This the lad was proud to do for her now, and he forgot what he had said, and he sat there proudly holding a bit of the fool's coat in his hand, while Pear Blossom made ready to go. So he sat, and Pear Blossom saw him thus when she had drawn a dark coat about her, and had set forth in all haste across the fields. There was that in these two poor creatures that even now stayed her a moment to look back at them, and it drew her heart out and curved her lips into a smile of sad tenderness. But she hastened on, for if she looked at these two with love, and she loved no one else now, there was such an anger in her heart as must out, and if it were a quiet anger, seeing her anger was always so, and she could have no other kind, still it was a firm anger, too, and she could not rest until she went and found the brothers, and found out what they truly did with the good lands they had from their father, even the land he had bid them keep for the generations to come in his family. She hastened through the fields upon the narrow footpaths, and she was alone, and there was no one to be seen in these byways except here and there in the distance, the figure of a man in his blue cotton work garments bending over his land. Seeing these, her eyes filled with tears, as they often did now and too easily in these days, for she remembered how Wang Lung used to go about on these very paths, and how he loved the earth so that he would stop sometimes and pick up a handful of it and turn it over in his fingers, and how he would never lease it longer than a year because he would keep it his own. And here were these sons of his selling it away from him. For although Wang Lung was dead, he lived on for Pear Blossom, and to her, his soul was always hovering about these fields, and she felt he surely knew it if they were sold. Yes, whenever a small chill breeze smote her suddenly on the face by day or by night, or a little whirling wind wheeled along the roadway, such winds as others fear because these winds are so strange, it is said they must be souls flying past. Pear Blossom lifted her face and smiled when such a wind smote her, and this because she believed it might be the soul of the old man who had been like a father to her, and dearer than the father who sold her to him. So with this feeling of his presence, she hastened through the land, and it lay fair and fruitful before her, for there had been no famine these 5 years, and there would be none this year either, and the fields lay tended and fruitful, and waving with the tall wheat which was still too green for harvest. She passed by such a field now, and a little wind rose out of the grain, and rippled it so that it bent silvery and smooth, as though a hand had brushed over it. And she smiled and wondered what wind it was, and lingered an instant in her purpose, until the wind sank into the grain again and left it still. When she came to the town and to the gate where the vendors spread their stores of fruits, she bent her head and kept her eyes steadfastly upon the ground, and she did not once look up to meet the eyes of anyone. No one paid heed to her either, for she was so small and slight and not young as she had once been, and clad as she was in her dark robe and her face without powder or red paint, she was not one for men to see above any other woman. Thus she went. If any had looked at her tranquil, pale face, he would not have dreamed that a good, deep anger burned in her, and that she was going bent on bitter reproof and brave for the hour. When she reached the great gate of the townhouse, she passed through it without calling out she was come. The old gateman sat there on the threshold, nodding, his jaw ajar and showing the only 3 teeth he had scattered here and there in his mouth, and he gave a start as she passed, but he knew her, and he nodded again. She went as she had planned, straight to the house of Wang the Eldest, for although she disliked him heartily, she had more hope of moving him than the greedy heart of Wang the Second. She knew, too, that Wang the Eldest was seldom purposely unkind, and she knew that if he were foolish, yet he had a kind, loose heart sometimes, too, and he could be kind if it did not trouble him too much at the moment. But she feared the cold, narrow eyes of the second son. She entered the first courts, and a slave was there idling, a pretty girl who had slipped out to catch the eye of a young serving man who waited in the court for something. And Pear Blossom said to the slave in her courteous way, "Child, tell your mistress I am come for something if she will see me." Now the lady of Wang the Eldest had been somewhat friendly to Pear Blossom after Wang Lung died, and far more friendly than she had ever been to Lotus, because Lotus was so coarse and so free with what she said, and Pear Blossom never spoke in such ways. Of latter times, when they had met at some common family day of ceremony, the lady used even to say to Pear Blossom, "You and I, after all, are nearer to each other than to these others, for the eye of our hearts are finer and more delicate." And of late she had said, "Come and talk with me sometimes about the things the nuns and priests say of the gods. You and I are the only devout ones in this house." This she said when she had heard that Pear Blossom listened to the nuns from that nunnery not far from the earthen house. So Pear Blossom asked for her now, and the pretty slave came out soon, her eyes creeping here and there to see if the young serving man was still there or not, and she said, "My lady says you are to come and sit down in the great hall, and she will come as soon as she finishes the round of prayers she is making on her rosary that she has vowed to make every morning." So Pear Blossom went in, and sat down in a wide seat in the great hall. Now it happened that on this day Wang the Eldest had risen very late, for he had been to a feast the night before in a certain fine inn in the town. It had been a noble feast with the best of wines, and behind every guest's chair a pretty singing girl was hired to pour out his wine for him, and to sing and prattle and do anything else the guest to whom she was appointed might like her to do. Wang the Eldest had eaten mightily, and had drunk more than he usually did, and his singing girl had been the prettiest little lisping maid, not more than 17 years old, but still so wise in her coquetry that she might have been a woman used to men for 10 years and more. But Wang the Eldest had drunk so well that even this morning he did not remember all that had happened the night before, and he came into the hall smiling and yawning and stretching himself, not seeing that anyone was there before him. Indeed, the truth was his eyes were slow to see anything this morning, because he was smiling and thinking inwardly of the little maid, and how she had slipped her small, cool fingers into his coat against his neck to tease him when he played with her. And, thinking of this, he said to himself that he would ask his friend who had been host where this maid lived, and to what public house she belonged, and he would seek her out and see what she was. Thus, yawning loudly, he stretched his arms above his head, and then he slapped his thighs to awaken himself, and he came sauntering into the great hall clad only in his silken undergarments, and his feet were bare and thrust into silken slippers. Then his eye fell suddenly on Pear Blossom. Yes, she stood there straight and quiet as a shadow in her gray robe, but trembling because she loathed this man so much. He was so astonished to see her there that he let his arms drop suddenly, and he broke off his yawn unfinished and stared to see her. Then, seeing it was really she, he coughed in embarrassment and said courteously enough, "I was not told anyone was here. Does my lady know you are here?"
"Yes, I sent one to tell her," said Pear Blossom, and as she spoke she bowed. Then she hesitated, and she thought to herself, "It is better if I do speak now, and speak out what I have to say to him alone."
And she began to speak quickly, and more quickly than her wont was, the words hurrying and pressing upon each other.
"But I have come to see the eldest lord. I am so distressed, I cannot believe it. My own lord said, 'The land is not to be sold, and you are selling it. I know you are selling it.'"
And Pear Blossom felt a rare, slow red come up into her cheeks, and she was suddenly so angry she could scarcely keep from weeping. She bit her lips and lifted her eyes and looked at Wang the Eldest, although she loathed him so she could scarcely bear to do it. And even while she did it for Wang Lung's sake, she could not but see how fat and yellow and loathly this man's neck was, where he had left his coat unbuttoned, and how the flesh hung pouched under his eyes, and how his lips puffed out full and thick and pale.
Then, when he saw her eyes steadfastly upon him, he was confused, for he feared very much the anger of women, and he turned away and made as though he must button up his coat for decency's sake. He said hastily over his shoulder, "But you have heard an idle tale, but you have had a dream." Then Pear Blossom said more violently than anyone had ever heard her say anything, "No, I do not dream. I had it from the lips of one who spoke the truth." She would not tell where she had heard it, lest the man beat his poor hunched son. So she held back the name of the lad, but she went on, "I do marvel at my lord's sons that you disobey him like this. Although I am weak and worthless, I must speak, and I will tell you this. My lord will avenge himself. He is not so far away as you think, and his soul hovers over his land still. And when he sees it gone, he will have ways to avenge himself upon sons who do not obey their father." Now she said this in such a strange way, and her eyes grew so large and earnest, and her soft voice so chill and low, that a vague fear fell upon Wong the eldest. And indeed he was a man easily afraid in spite of his great body. No one could have persuaded him to go alone among grave lands at night, and he believed secretly the many tales told about spirits. Although he laughed falsely and loudly, still secretly he did believe. So when Pear Blossom spoke thus, he said hastily, "There has been only a little sold, only a little of what belonged to my younger brother, and he needs the silver, and a soldier cannot want land. I promise you no more shall be sold." At this, Pear Blossom opened her mouth to speak, but before her voice could come, the lady of Wong the eldest entered, and she was plaintive this morning and vexed with her lord, because she had heard him come in drunken and talking of some maid or other he had seen. She saw him now, and cast him a scornful look so that he made haste to smile and nod negligently, as though naught were amiss, yet watching secretly too, and he was secretly glad Pear Blossom was here, for his lady was too proud to speak her full mind if he were not alone. He grew voluble and made a great fuss to feel the teapot on the table to see if it were hot, and he said, "Ah, here is the mother of my sons, and is this tea hot enough for you? I have not eaten yet, and was but now on my way to the tea-house for a sup of tea there, and I will go my way and not disturb you. Well, I know ladies have that to say to each other which is not for us men to hear." And laughing falsely and hollowly and uneasy beneath his wife's haughty silence and the stiff look she threw at him, he bowed and made such haste away that his flesh shook on him. The lady said nothing at all while he was there, but she seated herself and held her back straight and away from the chair, for she would never lean at all, and she waited for him to be gone. Indeed, she did look a perfect lady, for she wore a smooth satin coat of a blue-gray hue, and her hair was combed and oiled and smooth with oil, although it was scarcely midday yet, and at an hour when most ladies do not do more than turn upon their beds and reach out a hand for their first drink of tea. When she had seen her lord gone, she heaved a sigh, and she said solemnly, "There is no one who knows what my life is with that man. I gave him my youth and my beauty, and I never complained however often I had to bear, even after I had three sons, even after he went and took to himself a common daughter of the people, a maid such as I might have hired for a servant. No, I have borne with him in all he did, although I am wholly unused to such low ways as he has." She sighed, and Pear Blossom saw that for all her pretenses she was truly sad, and she said to divert her, "Well, we all know how good a wife you are, and I have heard the nuns say you do learn the good rites more quickly than any lay sister they have ever taught." "Do they say so?" cried the lady, greatly pleased, and she began to talk of what prayers she said and how many times a day, and how sometimes she would take the vow against all meat-eating, and how it behooved all of us who are mortal to think gravely of the future, since there are but heaven and hell for final resting places for all souls, until the bitter round of life begins again, and the good have their reward, and the evil theirs also. So she prattled on, and Pear Blossom did but half listen, and with the other half of her heart, she wondered heavily if she could believe what the man said when he promised to sell no more land, and it was hard for her to believe he could be true. And suddenly she was very weary, and she took the moment when the lady was silent for an instant to sup tea, and she rose and said gently, "Lady, I do not know what your lord tells you of his affairs, but if you can bring to his mind sometimes what his father's last command was, that the land was not to be sold, I pray you will do it. My own lord labored all his life to bring together these lands, that his sons of 100 generations might rest upon a sure foundation, and it is surely not well that already in this generation they should be sold. I beg your help, lady." Now this lady had indeed not heard how much of the land was sold, but she would pretend there was nothing she did not know, and so she said with great certainty, "You need not fear that I will let my lord do anything that is unseemly. If land is sold, it is only the distant bit that belongs to the third brother, because he has schemes to be a general, and to raise us all up, and he needs silver more than land." Now when Pear Blossom heard this same thing said over again, she was somewhat reassured, and she thought it must be true, if it were thus said again, and so she took her leave a little comforted. She bowed and said her farewells in her soft, still way, giving every deference to the lady so that she left her complacent and pleased with herself. And Pear Blossom returned to the earthen house. But Wong the eldest saw his brother in the tea-house to which he went, and Wong the second was there eating his noon meal. And he dropped himself down heavily beside the table where his brother sat alone, and he said pettishly, "It does seem as though men can never be free from the nagging of women. And as if I had not enough of it in my own house, that last woman of our father's must come and tell me she hears a rumor of the land being sold, and she clamors to get me to promise it is not to be sold." Then Wong the second looked at his brother, and his smooth, thin face curved into its slight smile, and he said, "What do you care what such an one says? Let her say. She is the least in my father's house, and she has no authority of any kind. Pay no heed to her, and if she mentions land to you, talk to her of anything except the land. Mention this and that to her, but let her see you pay her no heed, because she has no power to do anything. She should be glad she is fed every month and allowed to live on in that house." The serving man came at this moment with the account, and Wong the second looked at it sharply and cast it up in his mind and found it correct. He took the few coins out then that were needed, and he paid the money out slowly as though he did protest that the charge should not have been wrong somehow. Then he bowed a little to his brother and went away, and Wong the eldest stayed on alone. In spite of what his brother said, he felt some melancholy sitting with him, and he wondered with a touch of fear what Pear Blossom had meant when she said the old man was not far away even though he was dead. And as he thought, he grew very uneasy, so that at last he called to the serving man and he ordered a rare and dainty dish of crabs to divert himself and make him able to forget what did not please him. Chapter 9. Twice and thrice did Wong the Tiger send his trusty, hair-lipped man to his brothers, and twice and thrice did the man bring back silver to his captain. He carried it on his back and wrapped in blue cloth, as if it were some poor possession of his own, and he was clad in a coarse blue coat and trousers, and he was barefoot except for rough straw sandals. No one on the road, seeing this man plod along in the dust with his load and a bundle on his back, would have dreamed that he carried rounds of silver there, or that he was anything more than some common fellow. Although if anyone had taken thought to look more closely than usual, he would have seen that the man sweated strangely under so small a load as he had. But no one looked at him as closely as this, since he was so poorly clad, and his face was common and coarse, and like 100 others to be seen in a day except for his split lip. And if anyone stared at him a moment, it was only to wonder at this hideous lip of his, and at the 2 teeth he had growing out of the roots of his nose. Thus safely the trusty man brought the silver to his captain. And when Wong the Tiger had enough buried under his tent to last him 3 months until he could establish himself, he set the day for his going forth for himself. He gave his own secret signal, and the word ran among the men who were ready to go with him, and on a certain day, after the cutting of the rice harvest, and before the cold came down out of the north, on a certain night, when there was no moon until dawn, and then but a warped thing hung crookedly in the sky, these men crept out each from his bed where he slept, and they left the banner of the old general under whom they served. 100 men in all so crept forth on that dark night, and every man rose in utter silence and rolled his quilt and tied it upon his back, and took up his gun if he had one, and he took his neighbor's also if he could do it without waking the man, although this was not easy, for by custom every man slept with his gun under his body in such a way that if anyone moved to take it from him, he was awakened and could cry out.
This was because a gun was so precious a thing, and it could be sold for a heap of silver. And sometimes men stole a gun to sell if they lost too heavily at gambling, or if they were unpaid for many months when there was no war on and no looting, and so no silver coming in. Yes, if a soldier lost his gun, it was a grievous thing, for guns are brought from very distant and foreign parts of the world. On this night, therefore, the men who crept forth took what they could, but they did not get in all more than 20 guns or so beyond their own, because the soldiers all slept so warily. Still, 20 was good, and they could enlarge their number by 20 men. All these 100 soldiers were the stoutest men and the best that had fought under the old general, his bravest and most daring, his most ruthless and experienced among the younger soldiers he had. They were very few from the south, and nearly all were come from the wild inner provinces, where men are bold and lawless, and not afraid of dealing death. Such men were the more easily caught by the proud looks and the tall, straight body of Wong the Tiger, and they admired his silences and his sudden angers and his ferocity, and they admired him the more because there was nothing now to worship in the fat old general, who grew so fat he could not even climb his horse any more, unless two men hoisted and heaved his legs over the saddle. Yes, there was not anything to fire a young man in such as he, and so they were ready to desert him and to follow a new hero. Each man with his gun, then, and each with his horse if he had one, rose in the dead of that night at the signal, and the signal was when any man felt three light strokes upon his right cheek, he was to rise instantly and buckle on his belt with his ammunition, and take up what he had for a gun, and mount his horse or come on foot if he had not one, to a certain spot in a shallow valley that lay in the top of a mountain 5 miles away. There was an old temple there, deserted except for an aged hermit, dazed in his head, who lived among the ruins. And poor shelter though this was, it would shelter them until Wong the Tiger could shape them into an army and lead them on to the place he would choose. Now Wong the Tiger had already prepared everything there, and days before he had sent out the trusty man and his pocked nephew, and they had wines set in the temple in jars, and some live pigs and fowls, and even 3 fat oxen penned into an empty cell where some priest had lived once. These Wong the Tiger had bought from farmers round about, and he was an honorable man and paid for all he took, and he would not, as some soldiers do, take what the poor have and pay nothing for it. No, he had his trusty man pay close to the full value, and so the beasts were driven up the mountain to that temple, and the pocked lad stayed there to watch them. The trusty man had bought 3 great iron cauldrons, too, and he carried them up the mountain one by one over his head, and he set them on little ovens he built out of the old bricks of the ruined temple. But more than this he did not buy, for Wong the Tiger had it in his mind to go quickly away from this place, and as quickly as he could to the north, to some fastness there, where he would be safe from the old general. Not that he wanted to go near the northern capital either, lest he have to contend too soon with the state soldiers who come out sometimes against such lords of war as Wong the Tiger had it in his mind to be. Still, he feared neither of these very much, for the old general's wrath was short-lived these days, and as for the state, it was a time when one dynasty ended and no new dynasty had come up to take its place, and so the state was weak, and robbers flourished, and lords of war strove heartily together for highest place, and there was nothing to restrain them. To this temple, then, did Wong the Tiger come on that dark night, and he took with him the pale son of Wong the eldest, and it was a puzzle to him often to know what he would do with this timorous, downcast youth. The pocked youth had rejoiced in the adventure, and he had gone out merrily enough to do what he was told. But this other one hid himself out of sight, and now when Wong the Tiger roared at him to follow him, he crept shivering behind his uncle. And when Wong the Tiger flashed the light of his flaming torch on him, he could see the lad was all of a sweat, and Wong the Tiger shouted at him in scorn, "How is it you sweat when you do nothing?" But he did not stay to hear if there was any answer. He strode on through the night, and the lad's faltering footsteps followed. There at the pass at the top of the mountain which led to the ruined temple, Wong the Tiger set himself down upon a rock, and he sent the lad into the temple to help with the food. He stayed there alone, and he waited to see who would come to his banner that night, out of all who had promised. Then men came in pairs and singly, and in eights and tens. And Wong the Tiger rejoiced to see each one, and he called out to each, "Ha! You are come!" And he called out, "Ha! You noble good fellows!" Whenever he heard footsteps of those who came to join him as they came up the ruined stone steps of the temple path, he took the smoldering torch he held in his hand, and he blew it into flame and let its light fall over the faces. And he exulted to see this good man he knew, and that among those who had come. Thus the 100 assembled themselves, and Wong the Tiger told them off. And when all had come that he knew would come, he commanded that the oxen be killed, and the fowl, and the pigs too. Then the men set themselves heartily to such a task, for they had not eaten very good meat in many a day. Some lit the ovens and set them roaring, and some fetched water from a mountain stream that ran near there, and others killed the beasts and skinned them and hewed them in pieces. But when they had plucked the fowls, they stuck them upon spits of green wood that were forked branches the men hacked from the trees about the temple, and these fowls they roasted whole before the fires. Then, when all was ready, they spread the feast upon the stone terrace in front of the temple, a ruined terrace where the weeds were forcing the old stones apart. In the center was a great old iron urn, higher than a man is tall, but even it was crumbling into red dust, it was so old. By this time it was day, and the newly risen sun streamed down upon the men, and the cool, sharp mountain air made them famished, and they all crowded laughing and eager about the smoking food. And everyone ate and was filled full, and there was joy everywhere because it seemed to all that a new and better day was beginning for them under this new leader, young and brave, and he would take them into new lands where there were food and women and all the plenty a lusty man needs. When they had satisfied their first hunger and before they fell to again, they broke the clay seals of the wine jars, and into each man's bowl he carried they poured out wine. And they drank and laughed and shouted, and they cried out to each other to drink to this and to that, and most of all to their new leader. Out of the shadows of the bamboo thicket, the poor dazed hermit watched them beside himself with wonder, and he muttered to himself, thinking they were devils. He stared to see them eat and drink so lustily, and the water ran out of his mouth when he saw them tearing the smoking meats apart. But he did not dare to come out, for he did not know what devils they were come suddenly like this into the quiet valley, where none but himself had lived these 30 years alone, tending a bit of land to feed himself. And as he stared, one of the soldiers, being stuffed with food and drowsy with wine, threw away the thigh-bone of an ox he chewed upon, and it fell at the edge of the thicket. Then the hermit put forth his scrawny hand and seized it, and drew it silently into the shadows. And he put the bone to his own mouth and sucked and gnawed it. And he trembled strangely, for he had not eaten meat all these years, and he had forgotten the flavor of it and how good it was. And he could not but suck and mumble at the bone, although he groaned within himself as he did it, knowing through all his days that for him this was a sin. Then, when they had eaten all they could, and the remnants were strewed about the court, Wong the Tiger rose with a sharp, swift leap, and he leaped upon a monstrous old stone turtle that stood to one side, and a little above the terrace at the base of a great old juniper tree. This turtle had once marked some famous grave place, and it had borne on its back one past day a high stone tablet extolling the virtues of the one dead. But the tree in its indomitable growing had pushed this tablet aside, so that at last it fell, and now it lay split upon the ground with its letters rubbed away by wind and rain, while the tree grew on. Upon this turtle Wong the Tiger leaped, and he stood and looked down upon all his own men. He stood proudly with his hand upon the hilt of his sword, and one foot thrust forward upon the turtle's head, and he looked at them in his arrogance, his black brows drawn down, and his eyes glittering and piercing. And as he looked on these men who were his heart swelled and swelled, until it seemed his body would burst with it, and he thought to himself, "These are my own men, sworn to follow me. My hour is come." And aloud he cried, and his proud voice rang through those silent woods and echoed in the ruined courts of the temple. And he said, "Good brothers, this is who I am. I am a man humble as yourselves. My father farmed the land, and I am from the land. But there was a destiny for me beyond the tilling of the fields, and I ran away when I was but a lad, and I joined the soldiers of the revolution under the old general. Good brothers! At first I dreamed of noble wars against a corrupt ruler, for so the old general said his wars were. But his victory was too easy, and he became what we know he is, and I could not longer serve under such an one. Now, seeing that the revolution he led had no such fruition as I dreamed, and seeing as I do how the times are corrupt and every man fights for himself, it came to me as my destiny that I must call for all good fellows who were restless and unpaid under the old general, and that I must lead these forth to hew out for ourselves a place to be our own, free from corruption. I do not need to tell you that there are no honorable rulers, and the people cry out under the cruelties and oppressions of those who ought to treat them as fathers treat their sons. This has been so from the old days, even 500 years ago, when good, brave fellows banded together to punish the rich and to protect the poor. So shall we do also. I call on you, brave and good fellows, to follow where I go. Let us swear to live and to die together. There he stood, shouting this out in his great, deep voice, his eyes shining and darting here and there over the men who squatted on the stones before him, his brows now drawn, now springing up like flags unfurled, lighting and changing from instant to instant the look upon his face. When he had finished speaking, every man leaped to his feet, and a mighty shout went up from them, "We swear 1,000,000 years to our captain!" Then one man, who was more waggish than the others, cried out in a squeaky high voice, "I say he looks like a black-browed tiger, I say!" And so Wong the tiger did look. He was so slender and long, and he moved so smoothly, and his face was narrow at the chin, and wide at the cheekbones, and very high, and his eyes were wild and watchful and shining, and there above them were his long black brows, pressing down and shadowing his eyes so that when he drew them down, his eyes seemed peering and shining out of some cavern. When he lifted his brows up, his eyes seemed to spring out from under them, and his whole face opened suddenly as though a tiger sprang forth. Then all the men laughed fiercely, and they took up the cry, and they shouted, "Ha! The tiger! The black-browed tiger!" As for the poor, dazed hermit, he did not know what to make of all the shouting of tigers through the valley, and it was true there were tigers roaming in these hills, and he feared them more than anything. Now when he heard these great shouts, he looked here and there in his thicket, and he ran and hid himself in a small, wretched room at the back of the temple where he slept, and he drew the rude bar across the door, and he crept into his bed and pulled the ragged quilt over his head, and he lay there shivering and weeping and wishing he had not tasted the meat. Now Wong the tiger had all a tiger's caution, too, and he knew that his venture was but barely begun, and he must take thought of what was ahead of him. He let the men sleep for a while until the wine they had drunk was worn away and the fumes passed off from them. And while they slept, he called out 3 of his men whom he knew to be clever, tricky fellows, and he told them to disguise themselves. One he bade strip himself except for his ragged inner trousers, and he bade him smear mud and filth on himself as a beggar does and go begging in the villages near the town where the old general was encamped. And he was to hear and to see what he could, and to find out whether the old general was making ready to give chase or not. The other 2 he told to go into a market town and buy at some pawn shop a farmer's garments and his baskets and pole, and they were to buy produce and carry it into the city and loiter and see what men said and if any talked of what had happened, and of what might happen now that the old general's best men had run away from him. At the mouth to the pass, Wong the tiger set his trusty, hare-lipped man to watch and to search the countryside with his keen eyes, and if he saw any movements of more than a few men anywhere, he was to run without delay and bring the word to his captain. When this was done and these men gone and the others had slept away their wine, Wong the tiger took stock of all he had. He set down with a brush upon paper the number of his men, and how many guns he had, and how much ammunition, and what the clothing of the men was, and what their shoes were, whether good for a long march or not. He commanded his men to file past him, and he looked closely at every one, and he found he had 108 good, lusty men, not counting his two lads, and not one among them was too old, and only a few were diseased, beyond sore eyes or the itch or such small things that anyone may have, and these cannot be counted illness. Now as his men went past him slowly thus, they gaped and stared at the marks he made upon the paper, for not more than a scant two or three of them could read or write, and they were more in awe at Wang the Tiger than ever, because beside the skill at arms he had this wisdom also, that he could brush marks upon a piece of paper, and he could look at them again and see meaning there. And Wang the Tiger found he had besides his men 122 guns, and every man had his belt full of ammunition, and besides this Wang the Tiger had 18 boxes of bullets he had taken secretly from the general store, to which he had had access. These he had sent one by one, and his trusty man had brought them here and stored them behind the crumpling old Buddha in the temple, because there the roof was best and leaked least, and the Buddha sheltered them from rains driving in the gaping doors. As for clothing, the soldiers had what they wore, and it was enough until winter winds came, and each man had his quilt to sleep in. Wang the Tiger was well pleased at all he had, and there was enough left of food to feed them 3 days more, and it was his plan then to march out by night as quickly as he could to his new territories in the north. Even if he had not loathed these southern lands, he would have marched to another place, because the old general was so indolent that for 10 years and more he had not moved from this place, and he lived upon the people taxing them heavily beyond what they could afford to pay. And he took shares of their grain, too, and this he had done until the people were poor, and there was nothing more to be had from them. And so Wang the Tiger must seek fresher lands. Neither was it in his purpose to fight a battle with the old general over this stretch of overtaxed land, and he planned he would move on to the regions near his own home, for there were hills there to the northwest where he might shelter his men, and if he were pursued too hotly, he could retreat into the more inaccessible parts, into these places where mountains are fierce and wild, and the people are savage, and even lords of war seldom go there save at such times when they are driven into robbery and retreat. Not that he thought of retreat now. No, it seemed to Wang the Tiger that his way lay open before him, and he had only to be fearless and press on and make his name great in the land, and he set no defines to his greatness. Then the ones whom he had sent out came back, and one said, "The news is everywhere that the old hive of bees has divided, and a new swarm has come out, and everywhere people are frightened because they say they are sucked so dry, and they say the land cannot feed two hordes." And the one who was the beggar said, "I hung about the very old camp, and I smeared mud and filth on my face so that no one could see what I was, and I listened and watched as I whined for alms, and the whole camp is astir, and the old general is shouting and screeching and ordering this and that and taking it back again and saying something else, and he is all askew with his confusion and anger, and his face is all purple and swollen. I dared so much as that even, and I went close to see him, and he shouted out, and I heard him, 'I did not dream that black-browed devil could do a turn like this, and I trusted him with everything. Yes, and people do say the northerners are more honest than we. I wish I had him skewered here upon my gun, the cursed thief and son of a thief.' And he cries out every word or two that his men are to take up arms and pursue us and give battle." The man paused and chuckled, and he was that same fellow who loved to joke in his squeaky way. And now he said, and his voice went squeaking higher and higher, and he grinned through his mud, "But I did not see a single soldier move at all." Then Wang the Tiger smiled a little and grimly, and he knew he had nothing to fear, for those men had gone unpaid for nearly a year, and they stayed on only because they could be idle and yet fed. But if they were to fight, they must be paid before they would do it, and Wang the Tiger knew that when it came to such a point, the old general would not pay them, and so in a day or two his anger would cool, and he would shrug himself and go back to his women, and his soldiers would sleep in the sun and wake to eat and sleep again. As for Wang the Tiger, he set his face to the north, and he knew he need fear no one. Chapter 10. 3 days did Wang the Tiger allow his men to feast, and they ate all they could, and they drank the jars of wine down to the very lees. when they were fed as they had not been in many months, and stuffed and full with their feeding, and when they had slept until they could sleep no more, they rose up strong and quarrelsome and lusty. Now all these years Wong the Tiger had lived among soldiers, and he had learned well how men are, and he knew how to manage strong, common, ignorant fellows, how to watch their moods and make use of these, and how to seem to give liberty and yet hold all he could within the leash of his own will. So when he heard his men fall easily into quarreling, and when they threatened each other over nothing at all, or over nothing more serious than that one fell over another's outstretched legs as he tried to sleep, and when he saw how some began to think of women and long after them, he knew the hour was come when some new hard thing must be begun. Then he sprang upon the old stone turtle again, and he crossed his arms on his breast, and he cried out, "Tonight, when the sun is gone behind the edge of the flat fields at the foot of the mountain, we must start upon the journey to our own lands. Let every man take heed to himself, and if he has it still in his mind to return to easy feeding and sleeping under the old general, let him return now, and I will not kill him. But if, having set out with me tonight, any man turns back from the oath we have sworn, then I will stick him through with my sword." When he said these last words, Wong the Tiger drew out his sword as swiftly as a flash of lightning plays across a cloud, and he thrust it straight out at the listening men, and they were so startled they fell back one upon the other, and they looked at each other in terror. Wong the Tiger stood waiting and staring, and as he waited, there were five among the older men who looked doubtfully at each other, and at that sharp, glittering sword he held thrust out at them. And without a word, they rose and crept away and down the mountain, and they were seen no more. Wong the Tiger watched them go, and he held his sword out still motionless and shining, and he shouted, "Is there any other one?" There was a great silence over the men, and not one moved for a time. Then suddenly a slight, stooped figure stirred on the edge of the crowd, and it made haste to creep away, and it was the son of Wong the Eldest. But when Wong the Tiger saw who it was, he roared out, "Not you, you young fool! Your father has given you to me, and you are not free!" And he sheathed his sword as he spoke, and he muttered with contempt as he did it, "I will not dip this good blade into such pale blood. No, I will whip you soundly, as one whips a child." And he waited until the lad stood still again, his head hanging down as he always held it. Then Wong the Tiger said in his usual voice, "Let it be so, then. See to your guns and tie your shoes fast upon your feet and gird yourselves, for tonight we make a mighty march. We will sleep by day and march by night, so that men will not know we are moving through the countryside. But every time we come into the territory of a lord of war, I will tell you what his name is, and if any ask you who we are, you must say, 'We are a wandering band who come to join the lord of these lands.'" Thus it came about that when the sun fell and there was yet a little light of day, but the stars were out too, without a moon, the men filed raggedly to the pass, each man girded and with his bundle on his back and his gun in his hand. But Wong the Tiger had the extra guns given only to the men he knew best and whom he could trust, for there were many among these men of his who were untried as yet, and he could spare a man better than a gun. Such as had horses led them down the mountain, and at the foot of the mountain before they set out on the highway to the north, Wong the Tiger paused, and he said in his harsh way, "Not one of you is to stop except where I say, and we will make no long stop until dawn at a village which I shall choose. There you may eat and drink, and I will pay for it." So saying, he leaped upon his own horse, a high red beast with thick bones and long curled hair that had come from the plains of Mongolia, very strong and tireless. It had need so to be this night, for under him Wong the Tiger had put many pounds of silver he carried, and what he could not take he had given to his trusty man to carry, and certain others in lesser amounts, so that if one yielded to temptation such as may assail any man, no great quantity would be lost. But strong as his beast was, Wong the Tiger would not let it go at its full best. No, he was kind at heart, and he held his horse reined in and kept it walking, mindful of those men who had no horses and must walk. On either side of him also rode his two nephews, and he had bought asses for them,
and the short legs of the asses could not match his own horse's stride. Some 30-odd of his men were on horses, and the rest afoot, and Wong the Tiger divided his horsemen and put half before and half behind, and the walking men between. So through the silent night did they march, mile after mile, stopping now and then when Wong the Tiger shouted that they might rest for a little time, and moving again when he gave the command. And his men were sturdy and uncomplaining, and they followed him well, for they hoped much from him. Wong the Tiger was pleased with them too, and he swore to himself that if they did not fail him, neither would he fail them. And in the days when he was great, he would raise up every one of these first followers of his. Thus watching them and thinking of them as dependent upon him and trustful of him, even as children are in those who care for them, there arose in Wong the Tiger's heart a tenderness toward these men of his. For he was a man who could be thus tender, secretly, and he was kind to his men, and he let them rest a little longer now and then when they threw themselves upon some grassy plot of land, or under juniper trees such as are planted about graves. Thus they marched for more than 20 nights, and by day they rested in such villages as Wong the Tiger appointed. But before they came to any village, he took care to inquire who the lord of that territory was, and if any asked who this horde was and where they went, Wong the Tiger had his answer ready and smooth upon his tongue. At every village, though, the people set up a mighty lamentation when they saw them coming, not knowing how long such wandering soldiers would stay, or what they would eat, or what women they might desire. But Wong the Tiger in these first days had very high purposes, and he held the leash tightly over his men, and the more tightly because he had so strange a coldness in his own heart against women, that he was the more impatient if other men were full of their heat. And he said, "We are not robbers nor bandits, and I am no robber chief. No, I shall hew out for myself a better road than that to greatness, and we will win by skill of arms and by honorable means, not by preying upon the people. What you need you are to buy, and I will pay for it. You are to have your wage every month, but you shall not touch any woman unless it be such as are willing and accustomed to men for money and their living, and go to them only when you must. Take care for yourselves that you do not go to those who are too cheap and who carry a vile death in them and strew it about. Keep yourselves from such. But if I hear that any man of mine has taken unlawfully a virtuous wife or virgin daughter, that man will I kill before he has time even to say what he has done." Now when Wong the Tiger spoke like this, every man of his stopped to hear and to think, for there were those eyes of his glittering under his brows. And well these men knew that for all his good heart their captain did not fear to kill a man. The young men murmured with admiration, for indeed Wong the Tiger was in these days their hero, and they called out, "Ha, the tiger! Ha, the black-browed tiger!" So they marched on, or they stayed at his command, and every man obeyed Wong the Tiger, or hid it very well if he did not. There were many reasons why Wong the Tiger had chosen to settle upon lands not too far from his home, and among them was that he would be near to his brothers, and so certain of the revenue they would give him for a time, until he could establish taxes for himself, and he would be spared the danger of losing his silver by robbery along the way until it was brought to him. Moreover, if he met a reverse very sudden and great, such as is possible sometimes to any man if heaven turns against him, he could disappear among his own folk, and his family was so great and rich he would be safe. Therefore he shaped his way steadfastly toward the town where his brothers lived. But on the day before they came into sight of the town walls, Wong the Tiger grew impatient with his men, for they lagged at marching, and when night came, and he commanded them to set out, they were slow to move. And Wong the Tiger heard some of them muttering and complaining, and one said, "Well now, and there are better things than glory, and I do not know if we did well to come after a wild, fierce fellow like this." And another said, "It is better to have time to sleep, and to have no need for wearing one's legs to the knee, even though there be less to eat." The truth was, these men were very weary, for they were not used to marching so steadfastly. For in these later years the old general had lived so softly, his laxness had spread throughout his men. And knowing well how fickle ignorant men are, Wong the Tiger cursed them in his heart, that now when they were nearing their northern lands they could fall into complaining. He forgot that while he had been rejoicing in this north, and filled with content that he could buy hard-baked bread and sniff the good stout garlic again. These were still strange things to his men. His trusty man said to him secretly one midnight as they rested under a juniper tree, "It is time we let them rest somewhere 3 days or so on end, and time to feast them and give them a bit of extra silver." Wong the tiger leaped to his feet, and he shouted, "Show me the man who talks of straggling, and I will put a shot into his back." But the trusty hair-lipped man drew Wong the tiger aside, and he whispered peaceably, "No, now, my captain, do not talk thus. Cease your anger. These soldiers are only children at heart, and they will show such strength as you would not believe true if they have the hope of some little joy ahead, even a small reward such as a dish of meat or a jug of new wine, or a day's leisure to gamble. They are as simple as this, as easily pleased and quickly sad. The eyes of their minds are not open as yours are, my captain, so that they can remember to see what is more than a day ahead." Now while this trusty man pleaded thus, he stood in a patch of faint moonlight, for the moon had been new and now was full again as they marched, and he was very hideous to see in this light. But Wong the tiger had tried him so often and knew him to be true and sensible, and he no longer saw the man's split lip, but he saw only his good common brown face and his faithful humble eyes, and he trusted him. Yes, Wong the tiger trusted this man, although he did not know who he was, for the man never said anything of himself, and if he were very hard pressed, he said only, "I am native to a very far place, and if I told you what place you would not know the name, it is so far." But it was rumored that he had committed a crime. It was said he had had a beautiful wife, a pretty girl who could not bear his looks, and she had taken a lover. And this man had found the pair together, and he killed them and fled. Whether the tale was true or not, none knew, but true it was that this man had attached himself to Wong the tiger at first for no other reason except that the young man was so fierce and beautiful, and because of his very beauty a marvel to this poor, hideous fellow. And Wong the tiger felt this love in the man, and he valued him above all others, because the man followed him for no reason of gain or position, but because of this strange love that asked for no return except to be near him. So he leaned on the man's loyalty, and he always heard what he had to say. Now he knew the man was again right, and so Wong the tiger went to where his men lay outstretched and weary and in silence under the juniper trees, and he said more kindly than his wont was, "Good brothers, we are hard upon my own town, and near to the village where I was born, and I know every road and path in these parts. You have been brave and tireless all these weary days and nights, and now I shall prepare your reward. I will lead you into the villages round about my own hamlet, but not into that one place, because the folks there are our own, and I would not offend them. And I will have cattle bought and killed, and pigs also, and ducks and geese roasted, and you shall eat your fill. Wine you shall have, too, and the best wine in this country is made here, and it is a heady, bright wine, and the fumes rise quickly. And every man shall have 3 pieces of silver for his reward." Then the men were cheered, and they rose, and they laughed and shouldered their guns, and they marched that same night to the town, and they passed it, and Wong the tiger led them to the hamlets beyond his own. There he halted, and he chose 4 small hamlets and quartered his men in them. But he did not quarter them there arrogantly, as some lords of war will. No, he went himself from village to village first in the early dawn when smoke was beginning to steal out of the open doors, as fires were lit for the first meal, and he sought the village heads, and he said courteously, "Silver I will pay for everything, and no man of mine is to look at a woman not free to him. You must take 25 men. But in spite of all his courtesy, the village elders were distressed, because they had had lords of war promise them before this and yet pay nothing, and they looked askance out of their eyes at Wong the tiger, and they stroked such beards as they had, and murmured together in their doorways, and at last they asked for some earnest of Wong the tiger's good faith. Then Wong the tiger took out his silver liberally, for these were countrymen of his, and he left an earnest in the hand of every village elder, and he said to his own men privately before he left them, "You are to bear in mind that these folks were friends of my father, and this is my own land, and the people who see you see me. Speak courteously, and take nothing without pay,
and if any man of mine looks at a woman who is not public, I will kill him."
Seeing how fierce he was, his men promised him loudly and with many good sound curses on themselves if they failed to do what he said. Then when they were all quartered and food was being prepared for them, and he paid out enough silver to change the sour looks of the villagers to smiles, when all was done he looked at his two nephews, and he said to them with rough good humor, for indeed it was pleasant to him to be in his own country,
"Well, lads, your fathers will be glad to see you, I swear, and for these 7 days I will rest too, for our war lies just ahead."
And he turned his horse toward the south, and he passed by the earthen house without stopping, for he did not pass near on purpose, and his two nephews followed him on their asses. So they drew near to the town, and they went through the old gates again and came to the house. And for the first time in all these months a pale cheer was upon the face of the son of Wang the eldest, and he made a little haste toward his home. Chapter 11 7 days and 7 nights did Wang the Tiger stay in the great house in the town, and his brothers feasted him and treated him as an honored guest. 4 days and 4 nights he stayed in the courts of his elder brother, and Wang the eldest did all he could to win his younger brother's favor. But all he knew to do was to give him those things he himself counted pleasure. And so he feasted Wang the Tiger every night, and he took him to the tea-houses, where there are singing girls and players on the lute, and he took him to playhouses. Yet it did seem as if Wang the eldest gave himself pleasure more than he did his brother, for Wang the Tiger was a strange man. He would not eat more than he needed to stay his hunger, and then he stopped, and sat on in silence while others ate, and he would not drink more than he liked. Yes, he sat on at feast tables where men made merry, and ate and drank until they sweated, and must needs take off this robe and that garment, and some even went out and vomited what they had eaten so as to have the pleasure of eating more. But Wang the Tiger would not be tempted. No, not by the finest soups, nor the most delicate flesh of sea serpents, that are sold very dearly because they are so rare and hard to catch. Nor would sweets tempt him, nor anything made from fruits, nor lotus seeds candied, nor honey, nor any of those things which men will usually eat, however filled their bellies be. And although he went with his elder brother to those tea-houses where men go to play and toy with women, he sat stiff and sober, and a sword hung from his belt, and he would not unloose it, and he watched everything with those black eyes of his. If he did not seem displeased, neither was he pleased, and he seemed to see no singing girl above another in beauty of voice or face, although there were more than one or two who noted him, and yearned over his dark strength and his good looks, so that they made every effort, and they went and put their little hands on him even, and they drew out their glances long and sweet and languid and fastened upon him. But he sat on as he was, rigid and unmoved and staring at all alike, and his lips were as surly as ever, and if he ever did say anything it was not the things to which pretty women are accustomed, but he would say, "This singing is like the cackling of jays to me." And once when a little soft creature, painted and pouting, looked straight to him and sang her little warble, he shouted out, "I am weary of all this," and he rose and went away, and Wang the eldest had to follow him, although it went against him sore to leave so good a play. The truth was that Wang the Tiger had from his mother his scanty, sparing tricks of speech, so that he never said anything he need not say, and his speech when it came was so bitter and true that after a time or two men feared it when his lips so much as moved. Thus he spoke one day when the lady of Wang the eldest was of a mind to come and urge him a little and say a good word or two for her second son. She came into the room where Wang the Tiger sat drinking tea one afternoon, and Wang the eldest sat by a small table drinking wine. She came in with mincing steps and with much modesty and very proper downcast looks, and she bowed and simpered and did not so much as look at the men, although when he saw her come in, Wang the eldest wiped his face hurriedly and poured out a bowl of tea for himself instead of the wine he had there hot in a pewter jug. She came in plaintively and tottering on her little feet, and she sat down in a lower seat than her right was, although Wang the Tiger rose too and motioned her to sit higher. But the lady said, and she made her voice weak and delicate as she did nowadays, unless she forgot herself or grew angry, "No, I know my place, brother-in-law, and I am but a weak and worthless woman.